So last time, in our study of Luke, we looked at Jesus being challenged by an increasingly suspicious religious establishment. They railed against Jesus' blasphemous claim to forgive sins. When they commented that only God could forgive sins, they were absolutely not wrong. Their only problem was they couldn't somehow reframe their thinking to the fact that God had indeed come among them. Their observations were astute, but their conclusions, locked in their tradition, were misguided. Jesus perceived their errors and misconceptions about who he claimed to be, and he demonstrated it visibly with the healing of a paralytic to underscore his ability to clear and cure the man's greater need, not from his paralysis, but to be freed from sin. That was Jesus dealing with the true need that the man had. In our second story last time, the Pharisees accused Jesus' disciples of feasting and partying while their disciples fasted and prayed. But Jesus called himself the bridegroom in their presence only for a short time to celebrate the good news of the coming kingdom. Old jeans and old wineskins were not ready for the new wine of his Father's kingdom come down to earth. So today we move on to chapter 6 and two stories that relate to the Sabbath, as was read before. It starts off by saying one Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields. Jesus and his disciples are walking through the grain fields on a Sabbath. The disciples, including Levi, who had recently walked away from his wealthy career, were hungry. Presumably that was a new experience for him. He was rich. So they stepped into the grain and picked a few heads, ground them in their hands to remove the chaff, and ate them. Previously, when talking about Jesus' opponents, we saw that they'd been wary, and they had only accused his disciples of wrongdoing, of partying and feasting. But now they take it up a notch. While it's the disciples who are actually plucking the grain, it is Jesus that the Pharisees directly take to task. Earlier, they implied that if the disciples were doing things unseemly, that is, the likes of Levi throwing a party with his tax collector friends, it was Jesus as their leader who was at fault. He was letting them run amok while the Pharisees' disciples were fasting and praying. But now this opposition is gaining strength. It's not the disciples they attack this time. The "you" there, "why are you doing," is plural. And even though we have no evidence that Jesus himself was picking grain and eating it, he is addressed along with the others. So what exactly is their issue? Picking grain was an appropriate behavior. Old Testament laws of caring for the poor allowed one to take small samples from the fields. Deuteronomy 23 and 25 distinguishes between picking a little for your own needs, perfectly acceptable and even encouraged when it benefited the poor. The difference between that and industrial farming that not only involved work but also theft. If you enter your neighbor's cornfield, you may pick the ears with your hands, but you must not put a sickle to the standing corn. And remember that the use of corn as an English translation in the Bible is generic for every kind of grain, not just what we think of in the maize family. Despite the confusing use of the word ears, that I at least associate with long August days, lots of butter and salt. But back to the matter at hand, now that between talking about treats in class and corn on the cob, I've probably made you hungry yourselves, like the disciples. The problem is not with feeding a hunger, but that to some of the ultra-picky Pharisees, grinding grain in their hands could be considered work. We need to step back and we need to understand that there's basic good in the ideals behind what the Pharisees are trying to achieve. They saw their role as one of upholding the traditions of the people, traditions that they believed came from God. They were acting as shepherds over God's flock. No one can fault them for wanting to adhere to the calling of their God. The problem comes in that they had layered so many extra things onto God's commands that they were constantly on the lookout to ensure no one broke any of their traditions. With such a long list, it wasn't always God's commands they were upholding, but as Jesus says elsewhere, the traditions of men. The Pharisees, or rather some of them, as Luke notes in verse 2, in their adherence to the law was from a negative perspective. They pronounced things you could not do so you'd never run into the risk of offending God. I knew a Jewish man once who told a story of the advent of high-rise buildings in Toronto. When Orthodox Jewish people began to live in them, they faced the same dilemma as the Pharisees. What constituted work on a Sabbath? Elevators in high-rises were a new challenge. I'm not sure how these people dealt with stairs, but this man was of an age that as a child he remembered the solution to having to push the button in an elevator to get a ride on the Sabbath was something that his Jewish culture saw as work. Their answer? Hire a Gentile. I don't know if anybody had that on the side of their van or anything, but it was a functional solution. A man was hired to spend the day going up and down in the elevator, stopping at each floor to see if someone was waiting, because, of course, they couldn't push the button on the floor either to call the elevator. I'm guessing that in the interview process, they must have had a question about whether you suffered from motion sickness. The man recalled that years later, they did away with the human attendant, and an automated system ran the elevator up and down, opening at each floor for a potential passenger. As he put it, either way, the ride to where you were going was interminable as you stopped at one floor after another for mostly non-existent embarkees. And we may think this crazy, and as a young boy and then a young man, he certainly did. But it started out as a real exercise in interpreting God's command. Exodus 20. Remember the day of the Sabbath to consecrate it. 6 days you will work, and you will do all your work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath for Yahweh your God. You will not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male slave or your female slave, or your animal or your alien who is in your gates. Because in 6 days Yahweh made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and on the seventh day he rested. Therefore Yahweh blessed the seventh day and consecrated it. That was my emphasis there when I said some of those things in a more strong voice. I note that the Gentile man in the high rise must not have been considered inside their gates since he was made to work. And it was, of course, substantially less controversial to eventually have a machine do that work. But this was the kind of thing that the Pharisees had to deal with. Faced with these religious leaders trying to protect God's order, Jesus cut to the real why of the Sabbath. Jesus doesn't dispute that his followers are breaking the law. They may be, but Jesus avoids getting entangled in the legality of the situation. Instead, he reminds them of their own history and a deeper truth that needs to be remembered. Don't you remember what David did? His men were hungry. They were on the run from Saul. Saul, mad with jealousy as he pursued David as a rival, as a threat to his kingship. In fact, David was continuously loyal and did the right thing before both God and his anointed king. But David, forced to live as an outlaw, was in need. He fled to Ahimelech, the priest, and asked for food. That story is given in 1 Samuel 21. Ahimelech has no food except the consecrated showbread that was for the priests only. But he had compassion on these men. He agreed that if they kept themselves consecrated by the Lord, by, among other things, abstaining from sexual relations, then David could take the bread for them. The law was broken to meet a very real human need. Neither David nor Ahimelech was ever called out by God for this action. Indeed, Jesus holds this up as the appropriate response. Human need triumphs over the rule of law. Loyalty to God's intentions to protect those who need protecting, even if it means rules are broken, is Jesus' model. David was a man after God's own heart, and even more so was Jesus. Jesus drives this truth home with the statement, "The Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath." David was revered by the Jewish nation as the man chosen by God to act as king. In fact, a full five chapters earlier than his meeting with Ahimelech, Samuel is sent to anoint David as the new king of Israel. David, as king, had the authority to demand from the priest that which the law said he was not allowed to eat. Now Jesus makes this startling claim about himself. "I, the Son of Man, have authority over the Sabbath." And as we saw last time, he'd recently announced that he had authority to forgive sin. Now he proclaims it anew. "I have authority over sin and over the Sabbath." The Sabbath, he says, was created for the benefit of mankind by God himself. It was given as a blessing of rest to commune with God. It was established long before David's kingship. It was established before Moses' law. It was established before a covenant with Jacob, before the promise to Abraham, before Noah, before even Adam and Eve brought sin into the world. It was established by God to celebrate the completion of his perfect world. And it was given to humanity in order that they might honor God in the way that he himself had chosen to honor his creation, with rest and appreciation. Now Jesus says, "I'm preempting this. I see that these men need food in order to be able to worship their God. And whether this is work or not, that's not the focus." Jesus rejects the negativism of the Pharisees that this is not lawful with the bold statement that he, like his Father, will set aside rule and tradition in favor of need and opportunity to do the right and the good thing. Doing good is the theme that Luke picks up in the second story, beginning in verse 6. "On another Sabbath, he went into the synagogue and was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was shriveled. The Pharisees and teachers of the law were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. But Jesus knew what they were thinking and said to the man with the shriveled hand, 'Get up and stand in front of everyone.' So he got up and stood there. Then Jesus said to them, 'I ask you, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it?' He looked around at them all and then said to the man, 'Stretch out your hand.' He did so, and his hand was completely restored. But the Pharisees and the teacher of the law were furious and began to discuss with one another what they might do to Jesus." So Jesus is teaching in the synagogue on a Sabbath. I've often wondered, isn't teaching a kind of work on the Sabbath? But if we follow Jesus' logic from our previous study, teaching is bringing people closer to God. They have a need to know God better. Therefore, it's appropriate to do this kind of life-saving teaching on the Sabbath. A man is present with a deformed hand. We read between the lines to see that everyone expected that Jesus would be called upon to heal the man. Luke, alone among the gospel writers, in describing the situation, says that it was his right hand that was afflicted. And since for most people the dominant hand is the right hand, it's likely that this man experienced prejudice and was unable to work at many jobs because of his condition. People just wouldn't hire him. Jesus asks the question, is it right in the eyes of the law to do good? That's pretty rhetorical. The answer ought to be pretty obvious to everyone there. But he goes even further. If doing good is the right thing to do, then not doing good is not just looking away. Jesus calls a lack of compassion for this man an act of evil. He even compares it to saving a life or destroying it. And let's face it, a deformed hand is not life-threatening. But to Jesus, it's not what God's kingdom was intended to be. So Jesus puts it right. Jesus always took time from important things like teaching to meet the more pressing needs of his listeners. He fed masses of people from a few loaves and fish, because to not do so would be perpetuating uncaring, and that, he says, is wrong. He dropped what he was doing and let little children come and be with him. While others downplayed the importance of children, Jesus instead raised them to be examples of those who followed God with a clean and unencumbered heart. And now Jesus points out that this man's suffering need not continue. Relieving him of the weight of his infirmity held more weight than even the words he was bringing in his teaching. In Matthew's telling of this story, Jesus challenges them. Would you not go to the aid of one of your sheep who's fallen into a pit on the Sabbath? This man, Jesus says, is far more valuable than a sheep, and so he restores the hand. We don't hear of great rejoicing by this man at his healing. We don't even hear about the amazement of the crowd. What we do hear is that the Pharisees have been put in their place by Jesus and are furious with him. Now Luke says they begin to plot with each other what they might do with this Jesus, who has so upended their carefully crafted traditions. It's the beginning of true resentment that will cloud their view of Jesus and lead them to offer his life to save what they believe the nation should be. So what do we see in these stories that meets us where we are in our day-to-day walk with God? The first thing that I see is that Jesus was a master of turning things around on his detractors. When the Pharisees want to focus their attention on doing what is right according to their tradition, Jesus instead cuts to the heart of the matter. He reminds them that in that same tradition, David, whom they revered, broke a law by eating with his followers the consecrated bread destined only for the priests. In this, Jesus places human need above the rules of law. In it, he demonstrates the goodness of God in caring for humanity. And for me, that's a powerful reminder of how much God loves me. Jesus rejects the Pharisees' negative interpretation of God's rules that makes for a world of, you can't do that, you can't touch this. And he goes even further in the second story. This time, it's through a positive, godly worldview in which Jesus proclaims what a man might be when he is made complete and whole. A man who has been damaged for many years stands in synagogue, now healed at Jesus' word. In Jesus' words, the man has been a prisoner to his own body, and now he's been made whole. For him, the effects of the fall were manifest in a hand that would not allow him to fully participate in work, in play, and enjoyment of the life that God had granted him. So Jesus' actions are a model for us to follow. Feed, clothe, heal, and restore others to give them the opportunity to enjoy God's gifts. The second thing that I see in this story is Jesus' bold declaration that the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. In Mark's telling, he says, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." This is a powerful upending of the prevailing thought. Yes, God is absolutely sovereign, and we must do what he calls us to do. But here, Emmanuel, God among them, demonstrated that the importance of Sabbath rest was it was a time to commune with God. Nothing, including something as simple as a growling stomach or as debilitating as a damaged hand that prevented full participation in society, should ever stand in the way of the human to God relationship. You're more valuable than tradition. And Jesus does not hesitate to minister to need. All that Jesus does is so that you may explore your relationship with God in deeper ways. He's the Lord of the Sabbath. Next time, Jesus is going to take his love ethic even further. And I have to say to you that with next time for us, Lord willing, will be in September because we're taking a trip to celebrate Jan's retirement. Today, the story was recognizing that humanity is more important than law. Next time, we'll see that enemy love is the greatest gift that God has given us and what we must incorporate into our treatment of others. Today, you have the opportunity to make a step in drawing your relationship closer to God. If you've not been baptized into Christ, please study the Bible. See what Jesus has to say. Talk to someone in the congregation to help you get answers to questions you have about how to live closer with God.